So we're trying something a little different this morning. We wanted to turn it a little bit more into a teaching session, particularly for younger people who are starting out their labs. And we've asked a bunch of people to give short talks and then take a lot of questions about things like how do you choose a microscope, what kind of microscope do you need, how do you set up a lab, and then the final one will be how do you cope with this computational aspect. So I think everybody's in a big bottleneck and we all need massive computation and we don't quite know how to deal with it. So we've asked a bunch of people to give little talks and then we'll ask questions. Just a couple of other things too. We've sent out a survey and we really request that you fill that survey in. You know, our funding agencies want us to survey and find out if the course is any good and, you know, how to modify it. So please do send that in. Okay, I think we'll just get started then. And I think John and Henning are going to tell us about microscopes.
Okay, great. So, laser pointer. That works. So the questions that Henning and I are hoping to address are how to choose a microscope, what sort of microscope you need, how many people does each microscope serve, how you test to see whether the microscope's actually working properly, a topic close to my heart, and how you schedule time to optimize instrument usage and performance. I think the way we've decided to divide this up is in terms of the different contexts of our experiences. Henning will tell you about the sort of facility he set up and where he's coming from. I started my lab in 2006 at the University of Toronto, which is an extremely large university with around almost 70,000 undergraduate students. 16,000 graduate students, and this is the number that always surprises me because there are almost as many faculty. I think most of them must be teaching, and I have no idea how many staff scientists. I'm actually within a research institute at the University of Toronto Community, and that is one where there are about 240 PIs who are like me that are research PIs. There are many clinician scientists who do less than 50% research time. Got a lot of PDFs, about 450 graduate students, and probably a similar number of staff. In addition to the sheer size of this community, it's also one of the most dense scientific communities that exists in North America, where each one of these things I've labeled is a research center that does biomolecular research. So this is a context as the first cryo-EM person coming into this context, and what I was advised by some very knowledgeable colleagues and the decision that I made was that it would be insane as a new PI to try to set up a multi-user facility and even to just blindly collaborate with everyone who wanted to. There would be so many potential collaborations, so many people who want to use the microscope that you never get anything done yourself. And so in order not to destroy your career by becoming a service facility at an early stage where you really have to establish your own biological directions, the advice I was given was get yourself a microscope, one group, and that's your tool. So in 2007, we installed a Techni F20. We had a nice room built in our original hospital building. Back in those days, I actually had this mistaken belief that this is how a lab worked, where you tell people in the lab what to do. I learned pretty quickly that it's actually an inverted situation. So we installed our Techni F20, and then in June of last year, we installed our K2 Summit detector. And I've always kept my lab relatively small, so to give you an idea of the group that can be accommodated in this sort of setup, I'm labeling all the staff scientists, all two of them, in green, students in blue, and postdocs in red. And starting in 2006, the lab kind of went through this evolution, started with the lab manager, Stephanie Bueller, a few graduate students, some of them stay for PhDs, some of them decide that a master's degree is the right thing to do. There's one postdoc who became a microscope manager when I felt I could no longer take care of the microscope myself. And of course, we have a few people that are working in other labs. These are the best kind of postdocs, the ones that are paid by other people. So we kind of shaded in the pink. So I adapted the microscope usage policy that I saw at the LMB and made a few changes. The policy is that you can only book two sessions in advance. That makes sure that the microscope can't be dominated by one person saying they have lots of work to do. There are morning sessions, which start whenever, as early as you care to get to the lab, and end at 12:30 p.m. And afternoon sessions start at 1 p.m. and go until you as late as you like to work. You can book weekends, and that's kind of a loose policy. Some people really like to book weekend sessions, and you can book as many as you want, but if it gets unreasonable, as a small group, we sit down and talk about it. We've never actually had to say, you need to let other people use the weekend. We choose that negative stain sessions. Remember, this F20 is used for both stain and cryo, which is not really the best usage for a field Michigan microscope, but if it's one microscope, one group, there's nothing else you could do. We do our negative stain in the morning. because you know that if you get a good cryo grid, you might want to push that on. You might want to stay on the microscope. So this limits, this ensures that people doing cryo-EM have the opportunity to work with the good grid for as late as they want. And we're usually limited now by actually contamination of the grid with a side entry holder. So a busy week on the microscope. We use just Google calendars. We use Google Docs for a lot of lab protocols and Google calendars for booking the microscope. Blue are microscope sessions. This is a typical, relatively busy week. And it's quite busy, but if you really needed to get on the microscope, you could find some time to screen some grids or do something like that. So even in a busy week, that one microscope is around sufficient for the size of group that I have. And the question of how you schedule time to make sure the microscope's working properly, we always formally have an alignment session booked on Monday morning. Actually, since Samir Benlikber became my microscope manager, and he's sort of he often comes in on the weekend and works late and has sort of more irregular hours of a typical postdoc, he'll usually just schedule in an alignment session once a week, and it's not necessarily in the Monday morning slot. That's sort of a legacy of when I had my lab manager just doing simple alignments before the K2. Not so busy week looks like this. And so I estimate that we're using probably about 60 or 70% of the time of the microscope. It would be much more efficient to have more groups and more microscopes, but as the only cryo-EM group at the University of Toronto, that's the way it is, so not fully efficient. Now, when you choose a microscope, I think there are two important aspects. There's not just the good microscope, there's also good space for a microscope. And somewhat different than Henning's geographic situation is our situation in downtown Toronto, which is a lot more like what you'd see in downtown Chicago or New York. Formerly, Toronto is now a little bit bigger than Chicago, although that's really a misleading statistic. So here's our new research building. It's 21 floors of research for the Hospital for Sick Children. It's located over here. And one important thing to realize from this map is that we have subways and trams. And the important things about subways and trams, whether the flashy new models or the older ones, is they're 600 volts. And those produce very large magnetic fields. I think there's something else going on that I don't fully understand. The magnetic field cancellation experts tell me it's due to these. I don't really believe it. What I'm showing here is a DC milligauss meter. You can just buy this for a couple hundred dollars online. There's the probe. And then an AC milligauss meter. And I'll just show you what you read from these meters. So I'm going to turn them on. It shows you we're on the 20th floor right now. And you go back down and switch on the the DC milligauss meter, measuring almost static fields, and these numbers never settle down. So even though we're 20 floors up, I actually think it's worse in the summer, so I actually think it has something to do with the power grid of the city. Turn on the AC gauge, and some parts of rooms are good. This is just actually right outside my office. But if you put it right down there, you get to very reasonable AC fields. And just to show you that this isn't a bad instrument, when I first saw this, I saw this phenomenon with the DC fluctuations by our microscope. I went to several different buildings. I took it to my living room. It's there everywhere. But to show you it's not just an artifact, here's those pseudo-DC fluctuations, and now I'm going to put a mu metal shield on the DC gauge, and you can see the fluctuations just go away. So it's a real phenomenon. I'm not exactly sure what causes it, but it's a problem. So now you have the situation, and it seems to be worse closer to the ground. Also, big buildings, big cities have huge power conduits coming in close to the ground. The magnetic fields can be enormous. So here's a cross-section of our building. We just moved in about a year ago. The magnetic fields in the space where they originally wanted me to put the microscope, which would have been somewhere over here, were about 1,000 times stronger than FEI specification. If you go higher up in the building, you get a low-frequency sway of the building. So if you go down too low, you get strong magnetic fields. And my lab's right up here on the 20th floor. So we went around the building. This is, I think, the ideal way to do it. You don't always have this luxury. We went around the building after construction and found where the magnetic fields are okay and where the vibrations are okay. So now they're moving a new building, and I'm a little bit more experienced in what I'm doing. I thought it's time to pay back all these great colleagues who've supported me during my development. So I've taken on the responsibility of setting up a small EM facility. It is physically very small. We're going to move our F20 microscope into this new facility. We're still not sure what we can get, 300 kV. It doesn't look like we could fit Titan Creos there. We'd have to find alternative space for it. But we'd put another microscope here. And then the cell biologists really want a correlative microscope and a serial block-based microscope. So in that specific site, which we're going to start building even before we know what we can buy, the vibrations are fine, but magnetic fields are fine in one direction, and then there's this Z direction, that pseudo DC that we saw before. And so we are installing a cancellation system that should be able to take care of that. So when it comes to designing a microscope room, so it doesn't matter what microscope you get, if the microscope doesn't behave properly at where you put it, the room is inherently an integral part of the microscope. You need to find a place where the floor vibrations are okay. It's actually not too hard for biology. When I was first sighting our first microscope, Richard assured me that floor vibrations are almost never the limitation for biological EM. Magnetic fields can be, and so you either need to find an acceptable location or an active cancellation system, probably a combination of both. Acoustic noise is a bigger problem for biological EM, so you need to make sure that room is well separated from acoustic noise. They're calibrated for a point. So this is something that I'm not sure how big a deal this fluctuation is. It would be a big problem for STEM. When I was first installing the microscope, I contacted David Muller at Cornell, who's a very knowledgeable material scientist. EM has written several really good papers on how to build an EM facility, I'm sure. And I've also read the NREM papers, David Muller's papers. I contacted David, and he said that really the most vulnerable part of the microscope is between Bob's going to help me out here, between the objective lens and the projection chamber. And so a small movement there, when I did a calculation, I didn't think it was a huge issue, especially with the Z field, but still, the magnetic field cancellation system is insurance. You're buying a multi-million dollar microscope, it's a $30,000 system. But I don't think you could easily do two at a time because it does compensate at a single point in the room. Temperature stability, you do need a stable room according to the FEI statistics or specifications. And then, especially if you're dealing with side entry cryoholders, you want to keep the humidity low. So we do put a lot of energy into making it a dry environment so you don't get condensation on your cryoholder. It may be more forgiving with something like a Titan Krios. So then it comes time to choose microscopes, and you have several options, and they're all quite daunting. 300 kV should be better because of Ewald sphere curvature, because of charging effects, and because of multiple scattering events. 200 kV... We saw some beautiful structures at this meeting. Nico showing a 3.9 angstrom structure from Tom's data on the TF20 with a K2. So we don't know the limitations of 200 kV, and we think we can go quite far with that. But 300 kV ultimately will be the better tool. So it's a good microscope to buy, just don't let it kill you. A field emission gun, you need a field emission gun to do single particle EM. You won't be able to take out of focus images and still preserve high contrast and high resolution. Your choice for a stage, clearly a non-drifting stage is better, but side entry holders can let you get to high resolution, as we've seen, especially with drift compensation. It's much more convenient to have a three condenser lens system. That makes sure that you can always have parallel illumination, but you can still get relatively parallel illumination with a two condenser lens system. So the difference here is you really need to know what you're doing, but it's not that complicated in order to make sure you have parallel illumination. And it turns out we saw some seminars, you also need to know what's going on in the three condenser lens system to make sure it's set up properly. The constant power objective lenses, actually, they're constant power lenses, not just objective lens, those are nice. So you'd see these in the Titan Krios, the constant power objective lens in the Talos. That's a nice feature. The non-constant power lens is a disadvantage, but you can work your way around it. And then there's the prickly issue of which detector to buy. Well, we've seen that for current state of detectors, Falcon 2, K2, and Direct Electron, the counting of the K2 summit probably gives you an advantage for small particles. The Falcon 3 might partially compensate for that, and once all the detectors start counting, I think any differences will start to disappear. The Falcon 3 seems to have the best DQE at the highest resolutions at the moment, and Direct Electron seems to be very close to counting, and we're seeing some nice structures there. So that's actually a tricky decision. You probably have to make it based on... You could do it based on popularity, but then you'll be biased by which instruments people already have. So you could do some tests also. So to return to the questions, what do you need? You need, as a new PI, you need a simple microscope, one that you can use and run, and one that won't run your life. I think you can fit about 10 people per microscope, and probably more if you have multiple microscopes and arrange people so that the right experiment is done on the right microscope. Validating the instrument is important, so it's an experiment, and we will book a session if we want to check something, and so you can get on relatively quickly. And then to schedule time to optimize the instrument, we have that weekly alignment, and whenever we think there might be something wrong, like magnification, anisotropy, we book time to check that out. So I'll hand over to Henning now. so. We're going for a double loop system. I guess your question is whether those two systems will crosstalk. It's a good question. Yeah. Is that right? Okay. That's something to consider. Actually, that's worrying.
Yeah. We have two installed next to each other, but there's a distance about 2 meters in between them. There's a room in between two microscopes. But yeah, they do have this issue. But they said there's a spec is that you have to have a certain distance. And then the one we used is not a Spicer, but it's a Emmy Group or another vendor the price is much lower.
But I mean, the microscopes usually don't disturb each other, yeah, except a stem could disturb an SEM. But here, the cancellation field is a problem.
I wonder, right? In the big city effect, I presume that those fluctuations are going to be the same in the two rooms. Right. It could get very messy.
At NYU, they have two microscopes that are sort of across from each other. They both have field compensation. So if the two doors are open, they'll interfere with each other, but as long as you have the doors closed, they seem to be okay.
Thank you.
Now, the alternative is blue metal shielding, and then that is several hundred thousand dollars to shield a room.
Polaras, and they are, across the hall from each other, so they don't really bother each other. It's not a big deal.
So maybe it's a naive question, but why is the Faraday cage not enough or sufficient to shield the microscope?
Faraday cage for the pseudo DC fields.
Subway, I think, is several hundred amperes, right? It changes direction, so that may be cool. So, in Basel, I'm in a different situation. I took over a lab from Andreas Engel, which existed and which is large, also due to historic reasons. There had been Eduard Kellenberger and then Andreas Engel and Uli Ebi in that university that had done electromicroscopy since a long time. They inherited several old electromicroscopes. And then there's a big dedication and interest in that city for electron microscopy, also from industry. Roche Pharmaceuticals, for example, and Novartis is there, and neighboring institutes also. They all want electron microscopy. So I am in the opposite situation. I have a large facility with multiple users that all are interested in that. And I want to tell you a bit about my perspective on this then. So just assuming you negotiate a new position, you get your offer, and you have to now choose what type of instruments you want to set up and how do you do that. And I think the choice of instruments depends, of course, mostly on your own research interests. So what do you want to do? Do you want to do CLEM, cellular biology, or high-resolution structural biology, tomography, or single particle? That is your own situation. And then you need to decide if you want to have a big, expensive microscope yourself, or if you just want to travel somewhere to Janelia Farm or to the Leiden facility from FEI or so, which works better and better. And many people travel there and come back after 2 days with very nice data and then can determine high resolution structures from just visiting. So, and this will increase in the future. And you need to know who else wants to use your EM facility. Yeah, one group, one lab, one microscope is very comfortable. And in my situation, there's lots of people that stand in line and want to use our facility also. So that all influences the choice of instruments you need. And then you start speaking with the chairs of your department or the rectors of your new university about your startup endowment or equipment or so. So what kind of microscopes will you be able to buy is the central question. But as important is the long-term perspective. How will you be able to fund the maintenance of your instruments? It's very expensive. And when instruments are outdated after 5 to 10 years, how will you get the next generation of instruments? In the US, you can get shared instrumentation grants or big grants for that. In Europe, that's often very difficult. In several European countries, the only way to get a big microscope is when you get a new position. After that, it's very difficult to get big funding. you may need some permanent support persons. Are they? Can you fund them? And then we have startup funds for cash to start your own research. And in general, I think electron microscopy is much more expensive than most other methods in a university. And so what you will need is a strong dedication of your institution to electron microscopy. You will need to have the support, the solid support of your chairs and higher ups in the university to this adventure of setting up an own EM facility in this university. If you do not have this, life will be very difficult. And if you have it, and if you need your next expensive toy, and you have all the others helping out, then it's much more comfortable. And so during these negotiations, you have to pay attention to establish a good community also and have the people on your side. And if this doesn't work, then you better don't go there, is my recommendation. So fighting against colleagues and then being the most expensive one on board is a difficult situation. So you have to choose your instruments. And in my situation, that is has to serve many people. So you need a flagship instrument. I think we also need to prepare cryogrids in our lab, and we don't want to do this on the Titan Cryos. So you need some other instrument that can do cryo-EM and help you to find out how to freeze grids and have the right particle concentration and thin ice. And so. And you need a negative stain instrument, 120 kilovolts. So I think you need all three of them. Sample preparation can become very expensive if you need high-pressure freezers, vitrobots, freeze substitution devices, cryomicrotomes. You can easily spend almost $1 million with all these little things, not to speak of FIB-SEM, which is another million, with all these auxiliary things. And if they are there already because you inherit a lab, that's good, but if you're starting from scratch in the countryside, somewhere where this doesn't exist, that's an expensive thing. And if you do CLEM or tissue analysis, you may look into serial block phase SEM or so, and these are another million each usually. And then you need your cameras. And we have heard lots about cameras. I think there's three direct electron detectors from GATA and FEI and direct electron that are awesome and make a total change in our life now. And then there is TEETS, and TEETS cameras are much cheaper, 3 times or 4 times cheaper than these, but are significantly better than CCD cameras. And so I would recommend also looking at this company, especially for the lower end microscopes. Yeah, the price value ratio is excellent in your TEETS camera. And then which camera you want to go for here will depend on your situation and also on, maybe in the end it doesn't matter too much. I think we have seen great results from all of these. Falcons are faster, K2 Summit forces you to go to long exposure times, but that brings your microscope to better coherence. And then do you really need movies and how many frames, right? For tilted 2D crystals, we need at least 50 frames in a movie. So you cannot do this with a Falcon at the moment. That already eliminates that. But if you do tomography and you need the speed, then a Falcon may be very good. So there are lots of boundary parameters that influence your decision here. You need a direct electron detector. You cannot set up a lab without. So we worked on a small filament that's a helical structure. We worked for 2 years with an old camera and film and tried everything and just couldn't see anything for this. And then the new K2 camera arrived. And the first week we had such images, and Ed Egelman was able to turn this into a structure within another few days at 3-point-something angstrom resolution. So here the difference is not only higher resolution, but it's between not working at all and sidechain resolution. So you need this and you cannot do it without. And it's probably much more important to have a good direct electron detector than 300 kilovolts in your microscope. You should visit other labs that have the microscopes and speak with people there. How comfortable is it to use these? How steep is the learning curve? How expensive is it to maintain them? How reliable are the machines? There are differences among the different microscopes. Geol is not so much mentioned, but I think they have very good microscopes, and it's also worth looking at that company, in addition to the beautiful and wonderful instruments from FEI. In my lab, we have only FEI instruments. I'm very happy with those, but other labs have good results with Geol microscopes also. And what is also important is the quality of the service that you can get. Yeah, so in California, the Geol service was very good. In Switzerland, there is almost no JOLE service. You have to wait for a long time until a JOLE engineer would fly in. So this also influences the decision here. When you want to set up a lab, you should work with the vendors, with your FEI representatives or whatever it is. They are professionals. They are often brilliant scientists, and they do this since decades, and they do it every day. They speak with different labs. They have seen all the different lab layouts. They know their business, and they can help you, and they are on our side. They want to help you to get beautiful microscopes, and they want to help you to have these microscopes performing well. Because what they don't want is sell you something, and then the microscope doesn't work, and you don't never get a grant, you can't pay the maintenance, and you go bankrupt. That's the worst outcome for them after having sold the microscope. So usually I think you should work with them together and benefit from their knowledge and expertise. And then you have to plan your lab. That is great fun, to sit there with PowerPoint and make lines and say, this is where I want a wall, and then later you walk through your own lab. That's an amazing, nice, fun job. This was our lab in Davis, which Holland Cheng and I used, where we had a 300 kilovolt and 200 kilovolts and 120 kilovolt machines. You don't need a dark room any longer. You need a chiller room. You need sample preparation and so on, and lab space. And you should just ask different people, maybe by email, to send you their lab drawings. I did this with many different labs at the time. Derek Mills from Werner Kuban's lab, for example, sent me a collection of 10 different lab drawings, how different labs were set up as PDFs. And that's very helpful when you want to plan your own facility. So this is our current lab in Basel, which was mostly designed by Andreas Engel. Unfortunately, it's a long hallway, so a lot of area is lost with hallways here, and then we have all these microscope rooms. So we have the Titan there, which is here, and we have next to the Titan our console. Unfortunately, it's in the same room. It would be nice if we have remote control. Yeah, so this is the Titan console, the K2 computer, the motion corrector, and Legion, running on these. Here in NRAM, we have this very nice remote control setup, and that's going to be more and more important. The Talos is remote control, the Titans are remote control. So this is the plans for the new Biozentrum building that my lab will move into in a few years, 2018. And what we forgot so far is the remote control room. So I think we will have to modify these drawings and make some nice place as we have seen here in next door in NRAM's Scripps facility. So then you make the drawings, you give it to the architects, they start building your lab, and then things go wrong. And they almost always go wrong. So the first thing is the microscopes may not fit through the doors, or the elevators aren't strong enough or so. And the Titan in Basel had to stand in the rain for 1.5 days because the door wasn't big enough, and they needed to cut out the door frame, the steel frame, because the box didn't fit through. They didn't think about that. I heard of an elevator where the floor cracked. So you just have to do your homework and check that this is really working. The vendors may help you very nicely. Ventilation is usually too loud. If you tell people it's a very sensitive instrument, they say, yeah. And then when you move into it, there's this humming, low-frequency vibration that makes life or microscopy impossible. We told them this is like chamber music. You want it totally silent, and it's always too loud and too much wind. You tell them how many kilowatts your microscope produces in energy, and then they dimension the ventilation. It's just huge. Electromagnetic fields is an issue. John spoke about that. So you can ask FEI or some of these companies to come in and measure the site, and then if they speak with your chair of your department, they have a good position. They can just say, we want to sell your microscope, but not here. You need to find a different building. In Toronto, that's not possible, but in my case, that helped a lot to have also these experts being on your side and helping you in defending your claim for better locations. That's usually the best. Go away from elevators, go away from tram lines. Or so. Vibrations. So microscopes usually are in the basement, except for tram issues or subway issues. In Davis, we had vibrations from the ventilation, a big block, and it was then solved by putting that block on springs instead of the microscope. So we were able to eliminate the source of the vibrations. It's much easier than trying to shield the microscope from them. in Lausanne, they needed to put the electron microscope in the first floor, and what they did is they just filled the room underneath with concrete, totally, up to the ceiling, and 250 tons of concrete, then springs, and then 16 tons of concrete on top of that, and then a Faraday cage for $600,000 of new metal, and in there is a double CS corrected Titan, Temis. House cooling water. Our Titan is actually our most reliable instrument in Basel, worked nicely the last 4 years, except if the house cooling water failed. And that happened every 6 months or so. So that may be an issue. I think here you have cooling the chillers against air, that's more reliable, but then you need ventilation of the room. In some places you need a UPS, uninterrupted power supply, and Davis that was needed. In Basel, there was a UPS, but the UPS failed more often than the city electricity, so it was eliminated. That made it more reliable. And also here, I think the most important thing is you should benefit from the experience of these vendors, and bring them on your side and work with them. And you should not sign waivers and give them freedom to install the microscope, and if it doesn't work, it's your own problem. So better to just keep them on your side and work together. And they want you to be successful and get grants and results and be their best calling card later. So, in the choice of your instruments, you need to know what you want. Do you want STEM? Do you want tomography? Do you want tilt or no tilt or so? And do you need a CS corrector? And then you can speak with these vendors about all these options, and they can advise you what they can have. Sometimes they have ideas that you didn't have, and they are good ideas. And then you come up with some idea and some configuration, and you want to buy it. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, we can speak about this later in the discussion, I think. You have to announce a forbidding that costs you a few months. Maybe some other competitor comes in with a cheaper offer for a microscope with the same specs. You order it, and then it's built at the vendor's site. It takes a few months or half a year or something. Then you travel there, you test it, and if you're happy, you sign that, okay, in this configuration I like it, and then it's delivered to your lab and then installed, and that may take another few months if problems arise. Depending on the microscopes, and then is this acceptance test. Yeah? At the moment you sign off on the microscope and you say, this is the way I want it, and now I sign and I'm happy with it, then you void all your right to further modifications or improvements to the machine, and the warranty period starts counting. If you got it with 12 months warranty, that's the moment it starts. So some people say you should not sign this too early, because then you don't have any leverage to still have the vendor improve things, but then you may not be allowed to use your microscope, and it's just sitting there and it's not yet working because the contamination rate is too high or something, and then you are fighting with the company about is this acceptable or not yet. So I always signed this acceptance test quite early and made good experiences with that, because the companies I had to deal with what's Joel and Davis and FEI in Basel, they were fair and corrected every issues that came up later by just being generous, and I was very happy and satisfied with the outcome in the end. So I did not regret to sign this too early. I heard other stories from other people, but in my case, I think for me it was most important to work together with these companies and just trust that they want me to be successful. Then you need to compile your people or find your people. For a large facility, the lab is as good as your people are and not you yourself. So it's most important to have very good people, and the EM facility manager is the key person in there. That person has to be an excellent person on the microscope, but also with people, especially if you have a multi-user facility. Instrument maintenance is very complicated. It can be very expensive. In my case, we have so many instruments that it's much better to get a very good service engineer. Bill Anderson did this for us in the last years. That worked greatly. And then you may need a wet lab manager, and you need IT support. I think other people will speak about this later. We use an online system for booking, which is for free. It's a web page. Under this here, you can register as a lab, and then you have your administrator ID, and you can define users. Each user has a password, and the users belong to groups. Like one group is allowed to use the FEG microscopes, the others not yet. You can also have external users, and when they log in, then they see prices for the instruments, like so and so many dollars per hour. The nights are cheaper than the days. They have this booking system. It's all for free, and at the end of the month, you press a button, and you get the full billing information that you can just forward to your clients, and then they pay for access. Okay. This is what is a nice system. It's for free. So this is my situation. And now I think we should discuss a few issues here. So the first thing is the specifications. You said, Tom, you said this is companies don't want you or don't define specs anymore with you?
This is not really something new. For quite a while, FBI says, well, we don't care. These are the conditions. That's what you get. We could not negotiate what we wanted anymore, even before you set up in Basel. Mm-hmm. So you could still negotiate your acceptance test?
Yes, for the Polara, yeah.
For your K2 camera and your scheduling, are you doing annealing, and how are you handling that? And I guess if you have a K2 camera, are you doing annealing, and with multi-groups, how do you schedule that?
So we bake out the camera, I think, every once a week, anneal it, on the weekend. So it would be usually Friday evening, it's switched on, and from Saturday afternoon, people can continue working if they want.
And with the F20, we bake it out after it. We anneal the camera after every cryo session. So when someone's done, they start annealing, and then it stops annealing when the next user starts.
Oh, it is for handing. So you mentioned that you do not regret signing early on, and they work with you to solve all the problems. What problems were them, and what happened?
In my opinion, FBI sold the Titan, the first Titans, a few years too early. That's well known. The first Titans didn't work for a longer time. And Dominique Hubert was in charge then from FBI's side, managed that, and worked with every client and made sure in the end they were happy. And so in our case also, yeah. So we had the engineers come in after having signed off on the microscope, and Sengel did that, and they came and fixed it until it worked, and it's beautifully working now. Yeah, so.
Hi, yes. I just had a comment about room size specifications. So at CU Boulder, right before I got there, they built the rooms for our Tecnis F20 and F30 at the minimum size, and it was absolutely awful as a user and also as a facility that we were required to train people from all over the world how to use these machines. And so I think give yourself plus 20%, plus 30% when you're trying to design a room, because it's the minimum size is just too small when you want to have two people in the room with the instrument.
There's an additional advantage of a large room that increases the thermal mass and increases the stability. However, sometimes space is the most expensive thing, and sometimes there just isn't space.
So in my case, in Davis and also in Basel, the rooms are maybe 30% smaller than the minimal requirements by the vendors. Yeah. So it works somehow. Yeah. And this is rare. If you have student demonstrations and we have 10 people in the room, then it's getting difficult. But the microscopes work.
Something else related. You mentioned about UPS, and we have a UPS. We need it because once it's connected to the emergency power, the scope, or because then if there's a power loss, then there's always a few second or some millisecond or whatever the power interruption, and the UPS can help you to deal with that. Then you don't have to shut down the scope. But UPS has a generating field, so that you have to be either you try to shield it, or you better take them, put them somewhere else, and then a bit of distance. Otherwise, it could cause in the problem. You say. The other thing is really what Tom said about the spec. The one thing, FEI has a standard acceptance test for the instrument, as far as we know. And then the one issue for them is that the standard test sometimes is not completed. And we want, oftentimes want additional tests. And then some of these tests, I think, personally, I think are all absolutely necessary. And the way that sometimes they designed their test was not the right way to do it. But on the other hand, they also have an issue that they have a spec for the scope, and sometimes what their worry is that sometimes one lab, the scope is performs beyond the spec, and then they worry that everybody else wants that same performance, and then they could not deliver. And that's things that are different than the things that they should be able to do. For example, in our case, we always want to check the coherence for the TF20 or for the Polola, that you would need to show me tong ring, like 1 micron defocus. Tong, I don't care how many number of tong ring. I want to see tong ring beyond 2.3 angstrom at 1 micron defocus. Mm-hmm. And I want to see tong ring at 3.4 angstrom beyond at 2 micron defocus. And that's every instrument should be able to do it. And if they don't able to do it, there's something wrong with it. And then that's something that sometimes they do not want to include that thing into the, and then that's something I don't understand why, and they should be able to do it, and confidently there's no problem of that. And then that's something that as a community, maybe one can have a better sort of working with vendors, sort of have a more commonly accepted features that they can do it. And then the other thing I think is important is that you should have a regularly check the performance of your scope. And every time before they do something to it, and then you make sure that your scope perform to certain resolution, tongue ring, and all these sort of things. And when they did something to it, and then it fixed the stage or something, they should check the scope performance right away, and then immediately what happened before. Because otherwise, down the road, and you spawned, the scope doesn't perform well, then you have no idea when it happened and what happened.
I have another question. So the cryo has changed everything. Now you have these microscopes in a box. So my experience is also the air conditioning never works. That always goes wrong. But not just the noise, also it used to be the speed of the airflow and things like that, and they had socks and all these kind of things. So how does this now work with the cryos in the box? Do you still need to worry about airspeed and thermal stability and all these kind of things?
Well, one quick comment is when you're dealing with mechanical engineers who are setting up the airflow system, they're trained to try to maximize the air turnover in the room. And you have to convince them that you want to just get the minimum air turnover to keep a human being alive in the room. And it's very counter to their normal experience. But in terms of the cryos, Henning, good.
Yeah, the cryos is very, very stable. So in Lausanne, they have this Titan Temius, the double CS corrected material sciences machine in a room without ventilation. So it's just cold plates on the walls that are water cooled. But I think it's not needed. You can have strong ventilation. The Titan was introduced on an M&M conference in Hawaii, and where the Titan was standing in the middle of the big hallway with thousands of people walking around it, and they reached super high resolution on that fair. So I think the box is very useful. It eliminates most of that.
What's the thermal stability box?
The box is very heavy, right? There's this 4-inch of foam in the doors.
But I just looked and they specify 0.8 degrees Celsius peak-to-peak temperature variation, which is pretty stringent. But they say it's consistent with some standard office conditions.
Yeah. So more sensitive are actually FIB-SEMs. So yeah, if you have minimal thermal drift during a slice and view run that runs a few days, then the measurement is gone. So that's much more sensitive.
I think the other thing you have to remember is that there's other labs around you, and so once you're installed, keep an eye out for people having ideas like putting a zebra fish facility above your scope or, you know, moving an elevator or various things that can affect some of these fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another reason to get along with your colleagues.
Even without going that far, even a magnetic stirrer can actually screw up your microscope. But the other thing to bear in mind if you're buying a Cryos is that your room has to be at least 12 and a half feet tall, and that's the bare minimum, because they have a lid on top of the box, and in order to put that lid on top, they need that clearance. So rooms are usually not that high, and you have to bear in mind that. And they also require air quality with certain level, even though you don't need that much, you know, the amount of energy that it dissipates is not that high, you still need certain air quality, a certain dust quality, that so that all those specifications are still there, even though they're in a box.
So I think I need to catch a flight. So I'm going to run. I saw the other people on our ride leaving. Goodbye, everyone.